listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the holiday 2019-2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. The Vanishing. When Canadian blockchain whiz Gerald Cotton died unexpectedly last year, hundreds of millions of dollars in investor funds vanished into the crypto ether. But when the banks, the law, and the forces of Reddit tried to track down the cash, it turned out the young mogul may not have been who he purported to be. And the money is still missing. By Nathaniel Rich. Illustrations by Bianca Bagnarelli. Opening illustration, High Life. I'd like a boat I can cruise locally and then take south. And in this illustration, a man and a woman and their cat are shown on a boat, on a body of water, with an island and a house in the background. The Mercy of the Waves. The smiling boy visited Sunnybrook Yachts in the summer of 2017 after the value of Bitcoin had reached an all-time high, having tripled in 5 months. Sunnybrook is the largest yacht brokerage on Canada's East Coast. Its clients tended to be surgeons and litigators and sea suitors who travel from Toronto and Paris and Hawaii to summer in Nova Scotia. Their wives wear silks and manolos and perfect fingernails that cost $300 yesterday at the salon. The smiling boy stood out. He wore a wrinkled golf shirt, cargo shorts, and beat-up Birkenstocks, and he was obscenely young, with sandy hair and pale skin that appeared not to have seen sunlight since puberty. He was accompanied by a girlfriend who drove her own Jeep. They struck the yacht salesman as a couple you'd less likely see at Scaramouche than in a Walmart parking lot. Most conspicuous was the odd way that the young man always seemed to be smiling. It was a gentle, unflappable smile. It put strangers at ease. It made him seem lighthearted. It was difficult to imagine that this particular trait was contrived, but later, after it was revealed that nearly everything about him was a work of pure contrivance, you had to wonder whether the incessant smiling was just another part of the act. This summer day, however, he was dead serious. The smiling boy wanted a big boat. "What's your goal?" replied the yacht salesman in the delicate manner of his trade. A yacht salesman never asked what customers were looking to spend, or whether they had ever been on a yacht, let alone knew how to operate one. He summoned a future in which the customer was already a proud captain astride a luxury pleasure vessel dividing a turquoise sea. "I'd like a boat that I can cruise locally," said the smiling boy, "and then take south." He wanted to reach the Caribbean without having to stop in Canada or the United States. "That would require an extra fuel tank," the salesman explained, "and a desalination system for drinking water." They settled on a customized Juno 51 with a pink and cream interior, 3 cabins, a dining area for 6, a dishwasher, a gas stove, a washer and dryer, an ensuite bathroom with standing shower, and a swim platform with teak battens. When offered an electric motor for the life raft, the smiling boy gestured to his Tesla in the marina's parking lot. "Sure," he said, "I love electric." The whole thing would cost $600,000, but expense never came up, only safety. He named his boat the Gulliver, after the traveler who trusted himself to the mercy of the waves and swam as fortune directed him. Over several dozen hours of sailing lessons, the yacht dealer learned a few things about his customer. His name was Gerald Cotton, and he went by Jerry. His girlfriend was a property manager named Jennifer Robertson, or Jen. Her two chihuahuas, who liked to sun themselves on the deck as the Gulliver negotiated the islands and shoals of Mahone Bay, were Nitro and Gully. One of those bay islands, 4 acres of pine encircled by black sand, Cotton purchased that summer. He cleared trees and built a house, though he had no apparent plans to move in. The couple lived in a 3-bedroom in Fall River, north of Halifax, a rich suburb only recently carved out of a forest near a long, dark lake. Cotton owned a third home in Kelowna, in British Columbia's wine country, a fourth in Calgary, and 14 rental properties in Nova Scotia, including, in Bedford, every house on a dead-end street. There were also the Lexus and the zippy single-engine airplane, a Cessna 400, which he'd never tried to fly. The couple traveled abroad constantly, and they planned to sponsor a home for 12 children at an orphanage in India. In India, Cotton remarked, the Canadian dollar went a long way. Cotton rarely brought up his work, but details emerged. He was a founder and the CEO of Quadriga, Canada's dominant Bitcoin exchange, something like TD Ameritrade for cryptocurrency. He ran the business from his MacBook Pro, which he always carried with him. Once he left it behind on the Gulliver, which caused a momentary hysteria as the yacht had already departed the dock. He had Crohn's disease and seemed to subsist on hummus. When others drank beer, he produced bottles of hard cider. He loved to fly, planes, helicopters, drones. He seemed like the kind of guy who might retire early to an island somewhere. Cotton returned for lessons the following summer, though not as often. He was busy. Then, in December, Robertson called Sunnybrook to explain that Jerry, while on their honeymoon in Jaipur, had died suddenly. She wanted to sell the Gulliver. When national news articles began to appear a month later, they emphasized another detail. Cotton was the only person with the passwords to the accounts holding Quadriga's funds, cryptocurrency, and cash, worth approximately $250 million. Nobody knew how to find the money. The yacht salesman had questions, though it was not his job to ask questions. More than 75,000 Quadriga account holders also had questions. The Nova Scotia Supreme Court declared the company bankrupt and selected the accounting firm Ernst & Young to serve as its third-party monitor, responsible for securing the lost funds belonging to Quadriga's creditors. Additional investigations were begun by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the FBI, and at least 2 other law enforcement agencies that have not been publicly disclosed, though one of them is likely a federal agency in Japan. The most effective and thorough investigation to date, however, has been conducted by anonymous accounts posting on Twitter, Reddit, Pastebin, and Telegram. Their findings, though baroquely technical, could be distilled to a 2-word conclusion. Jerry's alive. He was not an evil dude. The initial portrait of Cotton that emerged in February 2018, once his death was announced through a Quadriga Facebook post, squared with the yacht salesman's impressions. Cotton was a computer nerd who had entered the right business at the right time and succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. The broad outlines of his story were blandly conventional, at least if you subtracted his interest in decentralized monetary systems. He grew up in a large brick house on a quiet suburban street in Belleville, the friendly city, a waterfront community between Toronto and Montreal, best known for its cheddar cheese. In 2010, he graduated with a bachelor's degree in business administration from an honors program at York University's Schulich School of Business in Toronto. His parents owned an antiques store. Cotton decided to go into crypto. A couple of years after graduation, Cotton moved to Vancouver and joined a clubby community of entrepreneurs who had become enamored with Bitcoin. He attended meetups at coffee shops and dorm rooms, organized by a core group of about 10 people who called themselves the Vancouver Bitcoin Co-op. Most of these early acolytes were drawn to the digital currency's libertarian ethos, its promises of decentralization, transparency, speed, and independence from governments and financial institutions. Bitcoin would enable more than 2 billion people who lacked access to banks to send and receive payment. It would offer stability to citizens of countries with chaotic currencies. It would eliminate all banking fees. Cotton knew the catchphrases and the talking points, but he seemed most interested in Bitcoin's speculative possibilities. The first Bitcoin block was created on January 3, 2009, and the currency gained economic value on May 22, 2010, a date enshrined in Bitcoin lore as Pizza Day, when a Florida man paid someone in England 10,000 bitcoins to order him 2 pizzas from Papa John's. The pizzas cost about $25, setting the price of a bitcoin at 1/4 of a penny. At press time, those pizzas would be valued at $82,373,500. With that, Bitcoin became like any other form of currency, a mass delusion. Its value derived from the belief that it had value. In April 2013, around the time that Cotton appeared in Vancouver, the price of a Bitcoin had risen to $266. But it was not easy to buy or sell if you lacked technological sophistication and considerable patience. 70% of the global Bitcoin trade was conducted through Mt. Gox, a Tokyo-based exchange, and had to be funded by sending a bank wire to Japan. Because Canadian banks wanted nothing to do with Bitcoin, users had to transfer funds through a series of intermediaries, bleeding transaction fees. It was so hard to buy Bitcoin in Canada, says Cotton in his unflappably peppy, inquisitive voice in a 2014 interview. You couldn't hook up your bank account to anywhere. It was just such a challenge. In November 2013, Cotton and an older business partner, Michael Petrin, an authority on currency trading with passions for Brazilian jiu-jitsu and luxury automobiles, incorporated the Quadriga Coin Exchange, or Quadriga CX, named for reasons that were not immediately clear, after the horse-drawn chariots of the Roman Empire. In a small, inefficient market, Quadriga swiftly distinguished itself. It was the cheapest exchange, the fastest, and by all appearances the safest, the first Bitcoin trading platform to hold a money services business license from FINTRAC, Canada's anti-money laundering authority. Quadriga installed a Bitcoin ATM in its office, the second of its kind in Canada, and accepted gold by the ounce, which could be dropped off in person. Investing with Quadriga was even patriotic. People like the fact we're located in Canada, Cotton told an interviewer, a point he often emphasized. They know where their money is going. Quadriga launched on Boxing Day. Cotton's efforts to win the trust of Bitcoin enthusiasts relied on his reputation in Vancouver, where he had become a director of the Bitcoin Co-op. He began to host the weekly meetups at Quadriga's office. Quadriga sponsored local Bitcoin conventions and educational events, investments of $500 or $1,000 that yielded incalculable goodwill. Often, Quadriga was the only Bitcoin company willing to pay for a sponsorship. From our perspective, we needed Quadriga, says Andrew Wagner, who at the time was the co-op's director of public relations. Without them, our events would have stopped. It put us in a particular place of need. Cotton's generosity helped to compensate for a social aloofness that, despite his implacable cheerfulness, prevented him from developing close relationships. He seemed to prefer acquaintances over friends. He was always smiling, really friendly, offering stuff, says Alex Salkeld, a member of the original Vancouver Bitcoin Circle. In January 2014, Salkeld posted a video on YouTube in which Cotton gently teaches his young daughters how to operate the Bitcoin ATM. Salkeld is certain that his two-year-old is the youngest person ever to have purchased Bitcoin. Cotton said he had a helicopter license and offered to take Salkeld on a ride, but he never did. In February 2014, 6 weeks after Quadriga launched, Mt. Gox abruptly suspended operations, claiming that hackers had stolen $473 million from customer accounts. A year later, Canada's largest exchange, Cavertex, announced its closure, also blaming hackers. The second largest exchange, Vault of Satoshi, closed the same week. Overnight, Quadriga became Canada's dominant Bitcoin marketplace. The following year, it launched a bid to be listed on the Canadian Stock Exchange, submitting to a full financial audit. "We're excited," said Cotton at the time, "to be able to provide an unparalleled level of transparency." Quadriga raised nearly, in Canadian dollars, $850,000 in private capital, but Cotton ultimately abandoned the effort after a dispute with one of the major investors. Quadriga's entire board resigned, leaving Cotton as Quadriga's only full-time employee. Despite additional travails, a software glitch that cost $14 million Canadian dollars, a cease trade order from the British Columbia Securities Commission after Cotton failed to file an audit, and CIBC's seizure of $21 million Canadian dollars from one of its payment processors after the bank failed to determine its rightful owner, Quadriga profited wildly from Bitcoin's giddy rise. In 2017, as the price of a Bitcoin shot to nearly $20,000, Quadriga processed nearly $2 billion in trades from 363,000 individual accounts. The exchange took a cut of every transaction. Cotton's reputation as a cryptocurrency true believer survived his death on December 9, 2018. Still, the eulogies had a prismatic quality. Viewed from an angle, they suggested darker possibilities. "He was not an evil dude," said Freddie Hartline, a founder of the Bitcoin Co-op, when asked about the missing millions. "He was careful and pragmatic." Another co-op member, Michael Jung, rejected the insinuation that Cotton had been out to make a quick buck. Said he was in it for the long haul. In February, the Canadian broadcast company interviewed Michael Patron. He was described as an ex-business partner who had met Cotton online over 5 years ago. "He was like a ray of sunshine," Patron told the interviewer. "The guy just always had a big goofy smile and laugh. He used to crack jokes all the time. He used to say he didn't open up to many people, but he was able to open up to me. Asked for his location, Patron said he was traveling between Thailand and Hong Kong. They wanted revenge. Everybody is a genius, said Albert Einstein, and every Redditor is an Einstein. Unsolved crimes attract amateur detectives who canvass the Internet for clues. The amateur's most valuable advantage is time. Law enforcement has the edge in nearly every other category: crime labs, informants, surveillance technology, forensic databases, the threat of arrest. When it came to the case of the missing Quadriga Millions, however, the balance was reversed. About 76,000 individuals held accounts on Quadriga, and some of the most technically sophisticated of them were out hundreds of thousands of dollars or more. Much of Quadriga's rise and bitcoins had been fueled by speculation from greenhorns who had heard something exciting about cryptocurrency from their nephew or cable news. But just about every cryptocurrency expert in Canada had a Quadriga account. They had believed in Cotton and felt betrayed. They wanted answers. They wanted revenge. Traditional law enforcement, meanwhile, had only the vaguest understanding of the subject. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police asked questions so rudimentary that they shocked the experts they interviewed. It's just completely out of their wheelhouse, says a Quadriga creditor and cryptocurrency expert who was interviewed after publishing his findings online under the moniker QCXINT. I spent a couple of hours on the phone explaining the basics to an RCMP investigator and came away feeling like he'd be much more comfortable with a dead body, a loaded gun, and a trail of blood. The court-appointed monitor, Ernst & Young, employed cryptocurrency experts, but was roundly ridiculed for a string of blunders that began when, shortly after seizing control of Quadriga's remaining funds, approximately $1 million was inadvertently transferred to one of the accounts that Cotton's death rendered inaccessible. There were limits, furthermore, to the scope of the monitor's investigation. Its object was not to track down every lost Bitcoin, but to maximize the pot of money that could be returned to Quadriga's creditors. For months, Miller Thompson, the Bay Street law firm appointed to represent the class of creditors, received hundreds of emails a day inquiring about the lost funds, and answered such a constant barrage of phone calls, heartbreakers about lost pensions and college savings, babies crying in the background, that its lawyers could do little else. Since the cost of Ernst & Young's investigation is borne by the class, it made little sense to spend resources on highly speculative inquiries without assurance of success. There was no such constraint on the outraged creditors or the true believers who saw in Quadriga's collapse an existential threat to cryptocurrency's integrity at just the moment it had assumed an eggshell veneer of legitimacy. Bitcoin was founded on the principle that no individual or institution should be trusted. Every Bitcoin transaction appears in a public ledger, the blockchain, that can be consulted by anybody with internet access. Within hours of the announcement of Cotton's death, a crowdsourced, scrupulously documented investigation applying the logic and methodology of the blockchain was afoot. In the public narrative that emerged, derived largely from a meticulously detailed investigation by Canada's Globe and Mail, Cotton fell sick 9 days into his Indian honeymoon, shortly after checking into the Oberoi Rajvilas in Jaipur on December 8, 2018. He was driven to a private hospital and diagnosed with acute gastroenteritis. The following afternoon, his condition deteriorated, and blood tests indicated septic shock. Before doctors could stabilize him, his heart stopped. He was revived and his heart stopped again. Barely more than 24 hours after the onset of a stomach ache, he was pronounced dead. The official cause of death was complications from Crohn's disease, but the gastroenterologist who treated Cotton told the Globe and Mail that the death still haunted him. "We are not sure about the diagnosis," he said. "No autopsy was requested." Confusion compounded confusion. The body was returned to the Oberoi and then sent out again to be embalmed. The embalmer refused to accept a body from a hotel. So Oberoi employees took it to a local medical college, where a staffer performed the procedure. The following afternoon, Robertson returned with the body to Canada. She left behind a dozen teddy bears they had planned to deliver to the Jennifer Robertson and Gerald Cotton Home for Orphaned Children. Robertson declined Vanity Fair's request for an interview. Next illustration, office space. Four desks in a weird room. No business operations going on. It looked hollow. A month passed before Robertson announced on Quadriga's Facebook page that Cotton had died. During that time, Quadriga continued to accept new funds but returned none. Creditors began to ask questions online about the authenticity of the formal documents in a country notorious for the ease at which falsified documents can be purchased, particularly after they learned that the death certificate misspelled Cotton's name, and that the former chairman and managing director of the company that ran the hospital had been convicted of financial fraud 2 months earlier. It was also revealed that Cotton had written his will just 4 days before leaving for India. It detailed $12 million in Canadian funds in real estate holdings, the Lexus, the Cessna, and the Gulliver. It left $100,000 Canadian dollars for the care of their chihuahuas. The will made no mention of the external hard drives, called cold wallets, in which Cotton had stored most of Quadriga's funds. This was the detail that most shocked cryptocurrency professionals. If trust no one was the first principle of Bitcoin, the second was have a plan B, and the third was have a plan C. If you lose the keys to your house, you can call a locksmith. If you forget the password to your savings account, your bank will provide a new one. If you lose the private key to your cryptocurrency wallet, a long, randomly generated password, all but impossible to memorize, your funds are gone forever. The cautionary tales of fortunes lost because of misplaced private keys have the quality in Bitcoin mythology of the homilies delivered at religious gatherings. It just seems so out of character for Jerry not to have any kind of backup plan, says Michael Perklin, who started the world's first blockchain security consultancy and had worked for Cavertex. He befriended Cotton in 2016 in Toronto, where Cotton had moved during the effort to take Quadriga public. Cotton had declined to solicit Perklin's services for Quadriga, but they worked beside each other at Decentral Toronto, a blockchain company that leased office space and served as the hub of the Toronto Bitcoin scene. Jerry was a very careful person who well understood the need to back up one's private keys. There's no way that a man like Jerry, with all his knowledge and his mindset, would leave it to chance. When Perklin read that Cotton was the only person with the passwords to the company's holdings and had made no contingency plan should he be unable to access them, whether because of incapacitation, kidnapping, or death, my jaw kept on dropping to the point where it couldn't have dropped any more. Cotton himself warned of this danger during a 2014 interview. He claimed he wrote his passwords on paper and locked them in a safe deposit box at a bank, because that's the best way to keep coins secure. shortly before his death, according to two Quadriga associates. Cotton told close friends and family that Quadriga had a dead man switch that would send them access to the exchange's funds in the case of his disappearance or death. Some of the earliest findings by the Reddit sleuths were more prurient than incriminating. In leaked text messages sent before his death, Cotton bragged about his extravagances. "I'm still cleaning the mess from our fondue party we had on the weekend, LOL. Mentioned having a safe bolted to the rafters in the attic, joked about retiring soon, and referred to his honeymoon in scare quotes. All of it looked bad, but there was no confession of criminality. On his personal YouTube channel, account name Jerry Rules, he had posted several dozen homemade videos as infantile as they were portentous. Jerry incinerating a $20 bill in his microwave. Jerry knocking over a Jenga tower with a giant teddy bear. Jerry stuck in an amusement park maze, repeating the same mistakes, unable to escape. The Instagram account belonging to Jennifer Robertson showed that since 2016, she'd taken trips to Machu Picchu, Dubai, Oman, Myanmar, the Maldives, and Rio de Janeiro, often in private jets. Robertson was also not her birth name. She had gone from her given name, Griffith, to Forgeron, and then back, following an earlier marriage and its dissolution, before finally landing on Robertson in 2016. The major break in the investigation was not a revelation exactly, but something that had been hiding in plain sight. It concerned Quadriga's co-founder. As it turned out, Michael Patron, as Michael Perklin and nearly everyone in the close-knit Canadian cryptocurrency community had known for years, was not really Michael Patron, which meant that Cotton was not really who he said he was either. It wasn't his first rodeo. Since Cotton's death, an ongoing conversation about the Quadriga affair has been conducted on Telegram, an encrypted messaging application that resembles WhatsApp, only with heightened privacy measures. The chat group Quadriga Uncovered has nearly 500 members, many of them creditors who use the forum to discuss details of the claims process and share revelations and theories about the case. The chat is also frequented by journalists, detectives from the FBI and RCMP, and several of the targets of the ongoing criminal investigations, including Patron, whose exact whereabouts have been unknown for about a year. In his comments, both in the group chat and in a private chat, he has minimized his involvement in Quadriga and declines to speak in detail about his past. But it was his past that early on became the focus of the Quadriga investigation. Patron had said that Cotton was like a little brother to me. This was how those who had known both of them saw it too, though the characterization usually wasn't intended as a compliment. Patron made people uncomfortable. He had seemed to appear in Vancouver out of thin air. At a time when the Bitcoin co-op was a small group of crypto enthusiasts who met in each other's apartments, Patron wrote them an email out of the blue expressing his support. They were excited. They usually did the outreaching. Nobody had reached out to them before. Patron came to the next meeting. "Hi," he said, "I'm Mike. I'm going to build a Bitcoin exchange. Let's work together." "It was weird," says Joseph Weinberg, the founder and CEO of several digital currency businesses, who was then a college student and an early attendee of Bitcoin co-op meetings. It was quickly very clear that he wasn't who he said he was. Sometimes he'd introduce himself as Michael from India. Sometimes he'd say he was Michael from Pakistan or Michael from Italy. But it came from a place of organization. He knew what he was doing. It wasn't his first rodeo. Patron denies saying that he came from other countries. "I'm not nationalistic." Next, illustrations, growing pains, and the original account, Cotton fell sick 9 days into his Indian honeymoon, shortly after checking into the Oberoi Rajvilas in Jaipur on December 8, 2018. And in these illustrations, one in which he appears sweaty and sick with his wife in the background, and another in which he's being helped to a car. Patron was described as ostentatiously secretive, a trait not uncommon in cryptocurrency circles, and made vague allusions to a shadowy past and underworld connections. He was sturdy and muscular, with black work tattoos and a face that in repose seemed to glower. On Facebook, he posed with a tiger, a lion, behind the wheel of a Lamborghini, straddling an ATV in a desert. Friends say he spoke of an emotionally absent father, manipulative family members, his obsessive-compulsive tendencies. He ranted about his hatred of scam artists, though his definition of the term seemed rather idiosyncratic. Identity theft was a clean, bloodless business, but when you lied to someone's face, it was unforgivable. He saw himself as an enforcer of rules, of integrity, of loyalty. He seemed lonely. One day he showed up with Cotton, who behaved like a runt little brother, but, as one friend put it in a gross kind of way, sycophantic, almost submissive. When Patron told a stupid joke that nobody found funny, Cotton would burst into wild laughter. They were an odd pair. Patron told reporters after Cotton's death that they had met online over 5 years ago, but this was about as accurate as calling himself an advisor to Quadriga, when, in fact, he had been the co-founder. By painstakingly searching archived data from deleted websites, communicating on encrypted messaging services with anonymous sources, and analyzing public registration data, the Quadriga creditor, who goes by the online moniker QCXINT, had a handful of other obsessives with handles like RunBTC and Zero Nonsense reconstructed the pair's entangled online lives. They traced the relationship back to 2003 to a dingy warren of a website called Talk Gold. It was devoted to high-yield investment programs, or HYIPs, more commonly known as Ponzi schemes. Gerald Cotton may have had a sophisticated grasp of cryptocurrency, but his expertise, his formal training, lay in the art of the confidence game. Talk Gold was a Ponzi clearinghouse where blind faith and curdled cynicism engaged in a demonic rumba. Flickering banner ads for investments in precious metals and foreign exchange funds and real offshore returns buffered message boards offering something for everyone, scammers, marks, and those who belonged to both categories. There were forums promoting promising new HYIPs, scam warnings, advice on creating one's own Ponzi or how to get out early enough to profit, and offers of payment to boost fraudulent schemes on the site. Talk Gold was run by twins Edward and Brian Krasenstein until 2016. When agents from the Office of Homeland Security seized their files and froze their assets, but never charged them with a crime. Subsequently, the brothers would gain Twitter notoriety for their incessant attacks on Donald Trump before they were shut down for operating fake accounts and purchasing followers. Patron joined Talk Gold on April 3, 2003, the year the site launched. In one of his first posts, he boasted of earning 30% monthly returns in HYIP investments. Cotton opened his account 3 months later, shortly after his 15th birthday. Both would become regulars on the message boards, board whores, and seek each other out on similar HYIP sites. Cotton averaged 4 posts a day on Top Gold alone. Patron would tell friends that they'd first met in a con artist meet-cute, like the thieves in an Ernest Lubitsch film who fall in love while picking each other's pockets. Cotton tried to scam Patron. Patron tried to counter-scam Cotton. Soon they were responding to each other's public posts with inside jokes. Cotton was a quick study. He began his own HYIP chat site by December, and on January 1st, 2004, he was 15 and a half, he launched his first pyramid scheme, S&S Investments. It promised within 48 hours, usually within 18, a return of 103% to 150%, possibly more. In its prospectus, Cotton wrote, "I'm afraid I'm not going to fill this section of the page with the usual bumf about how your returns are made. We do not invest in stocks, bonds, shares, precious metals, or antiques. All I will say is that we will generate your return and that we are not what is called a Ponzi or a pyramid scheme." When S&S suspended operations 3 months later, taking most of its clients' funds with it, Patron took to Top Gold to defend Cotton's integrity. In isolation, this might be written off as teenage hijinks, or at most, light fraud. Patron, though 6 years older than Cotton, was only 21. Both men soon graduated, however. In October 2004, Top Gold members began to debate whether Patron might in fact be Omar Danani, one of 28 suspects who had been arrested by the U.S. Secret Service in a global sting operation targeting an online marketplace for stolen credit card information and forged documents. Danani, who was known on another message board as an expert in washing funds, was arrested in Southern California, where he was living with his family. Upon pleading guilty to conspiring to transfer stolen identification documents, he was sentenced to 18 months in federal prison. After his release in 2007, he was deported to Canada. In a gambit of either flagrant carelessness or irrepressible egotism, Danani officially changed his name to the pseudonym he had used in his online criminal ventures, first to Omar Patron and later to Michael Patron. Many who were born without white privilege, including nearly every Chinese person I've met in Vancouver, has anglicized their name, says Patron. I was one of 5 non-whites working in capital markets in Vancouver. Patron shortly resumed posting on Top Gold and other HYIP forums and opened a series of businesses that brokered digital currencies. The most successful of these was Midas Gold, incorporated in early 2008. It served as an independent payment processor for Liberty Reserve, a digital currency that was operated by an American in Costa Rica and used by drug cartels, human traffickers, child pornographers, and Ponzi's to launder money. Midas Gold was an intermediary between Liberty Reserve and its traders, transferring cash into digital currency and back again, ensuring that no centralized record of clients existed. In its registration documents, Midas Gold listed as its contact gerald.cotton@gmail.com. Cotton ran his own succession of schemes throughout those years, during which he also attended an undergraduate honors program at York University's Schulich School of Business. In HYIP chat rooms, Cotton and Patron defended each other against angry investors and posed as satisfied clients of each other's various businesses. Patrons tended to be payment processors. Cotton's were marginally more sophisticated iterations of S&S Investments. Their company's websites often shared registration information and were operated by the same computers. Around this time, Patron changed the slug that appeared beneath his Top Gold post to the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, Benjamin Franklin. On May 24, 2013, federal agents in 17 countries arrested Liberty Reserve's administrators, shuttering its website and seizing its records and bank accounts. It was the largest online money laundering case in American history. Liberty Reserve's 5.5 million user accounts had conducted 78 million transactions worth more than $8 billion. The global enforcement action we announced today is an important step toward reigning in the wild west of illicit internet banking, said Preet Bharara, then the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Midas Gold, which had begun to accept Bitcoin, was seized too. By that point, however, a new Gerald Cotton venture was already 6 months old. The Quadriga Fund was an HYIP that claimed to invest in venture capital projects and foreign currency exchange markets. It could be funded with Liberty Reserve and Bitcoin using payment processors operated by Patron. A quadriga is a chariot yoked to four horses abreast. Quadriga Fund claimed to be operated by four unnamed investment managers. Wealth is freedom, read the prospectus. When you invest with Quadriga, you remain in control. In October 2013, Cotton placed a job posting on an online forum, Black Hat World, that marketed frauds and stolen goods. He sought a programmer who was familiar with Bitcoin to develop a website that would serve as an open marketplace, like a stock market, where people buy and sell Bitcoin. The design had to be simple but professional, and it had to be built quickly. Less than 3 months later, the Quadriga Fund was dead, and Quadriga CX went live. A real MF. If Quadriga was conceived as a scam, what kind of scam was it? Most HYIPs, including those previously operated by Cotton, were exit scams. Ponzi's that, after reaching a critical volume, abruptly close up shop. In some exits, the operator simply vanishes with the funds. More commonly, however, he will blame external forces, a meddlesome bank that freezes its accounts, provide fragmentary refunds, and equivocate until its investors give up hope. The delay tactic is more successful than might be expected, since customers of HYIPs understand, on some fundamental level, that promises of outsized returns are too good to be true. Besides, there was always another outrageous bargain a few clicks away. The same blind faith that attracts the marks also drives them away. Or perhaps Quadriga was to resemble Cotton and Patron's previous collaboration, Midas Gold, a service that enabled money laundering, taking percentages of each transaction. Quadriga's corporate accounts did trade tens of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin with accounts connected to known Ponzi schemes and illegal marketplaces. Some of the early visitors to the Vancouver Quadriga office even thought the exchange was just a show. When you walked in, it was a very fronty feeling, says Joseph Weinberg. Four desks in a weird room. No business operations going on. It looked hollow. Weinberg and several others who visited the office for Bitcoin meetups saw stacks of hundreds of payroll checks in the names of businesses that were not Quadriga, addressed to people who were not Quadriga employees. In response to these allegations, Patron denied the existence of check printing machines and pay stubs and suggested that visitors to the office were confused by scanners and cash counters. The ethical distinctions between the models may have been vanishingly subtle, but the logic of the con would predict its fate and Cotton's. Was Quadriga built to last, in other words? or built to self-destruct. It was not built in its early days to make money. According to Quadriga's last public filings in 2015, it operated in a deficit. Under the most charitable interpretation of Cotton's actions, the public bid marks the moment that he decided to go straight. Perhaps, this scenario goes, Cotton believed that the cryptocurrency bull market would continue indefinitely, leading to higher trading volumes and profits. Cotton would have forced Patron out, knowing that with intensified public scrutiny, his past would become a liability. This would have been a startling about-face. In the early days, those who knew them believed that the company belonged to Patron, with Cotton serving as a front man. Michael was obviously running the show, but it was a very quiet running, says Weinberg. It seemed like they had an understanding and shared motives. Gerald had a clean record. He could speak to the masses, while Michael operated the back end. Patron, I would say that the opposite is more accurate. Jerry and Alex Hannon, a web developer, created and ran Quadriga with Jerry running operations. By 2015, however, the same information that the Talk Gold community had gleaned a decade earlier was starting to surface on Reddit, that Michael Patron was really Omar Danani, a convicted thief and defrauder with ties to organized crime. The Whisper campaign really began after Ryan Muller, who conducted oversight for a third-party processor in Vancouver, was asked to review Quadriga's application. After hearing that Patron had been bragging all over Vancouver about his talent for laundering money, Muller unearthed the connection to Danani. He rejected Quadriga's application and forwarded his investigation to contacts and law enforcement. Nobody followed up with him. Muller didn't understand how a federal convict had been able to change his name, continue to operate, and escape charges. He figured that Danani had friends in the underworld and in federal law enforcement. He's what you'd call, says Muller, a real MF. Among those Muller warned was Amber Scott, an anti-money laundering expert at a compliance firm in Toronto called Outlier Solutions. She told clients and friends to avoid Quadriga, but when she met Cotton at the Toronto Bitcoin Hub Decentral, she found him funny and sweet. She believed in him. She decided that his involvement might mean that Quadriga was legitimate after all. She appeared with him and even introduced him at conferences. There was a high tolerance for risk in the community, especially in 2015, she says today. We all want Bitcoin to succeed, and businesses in the Bitcoin industry to succeed, which encourages some level of self-delusion. There was also the fact that these were Canadian people, Canadian companies. We didn't want to cast doubt on our own scene. While I warned people privately, I wasn't shouting it from the rooftops. I don't get to hold myself blameless. Once, Cotton mentioned that his business partner was visiting Toronto and asked her to coffee. She froze and said something about having to shampoo her cats. Cotton flushed. He never mentioned Patron in her presence again. Patron's departure was followed by the departure of the rest of the board, which included Patron's fiancé named Lovey Horner and Anthony Molesky, a Patron associate reportedly backed by Russian mining interest. Jerry appeared to have taken full control, says Andrew Wagner. We thought, finally, Jerry is standing up to Mike. The little brother under the thumb finally grew some balls. That was our perception, at least. Patron has argued the reverse, that he quit Quadriga because he disagreed with Cotton's decision to abandon the public listing. Jerry stopped running the company legally and ethically from a filing standpoint after all of the employees, directors, and officers left in January 2016, he wrote recently, We had no idea about the Ponzi aspect. In the fall of 2016, Bitcoin began its wild rise, but it was too much, too fast. The young, inexperienced cryptocurrency purist was overwhelmed, beset by coding errors, scrutiny from banks, incompetent contractors, and crooked payment processors. He had to report to increasingly questionable practices. He had to resort to increasingly questionable practices in a desperate effort to salvage his dream. If you blur your eyes, this narrative, Jerry tries to make good, nearly coheres. Their wallets were empty. Far more likely is the narrative of Jerry the Royal F-Up. In this version of the story, scams beget scams, and incompetence snowballs into recklessness and squander. The public bid was a last-ditch effort to salvage a flailing Ponzi. Exploiting positive press and public sympathy to bilk money from investors. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.